Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. This is your host, Mark Whitby, and I'm excited to be joined today by Simon LaFosse. Simon is the founder and executive chairman of the technology recruitment business, LaFosse Associates. He also more recently founded a rapidly growing subsidiary business called Futureproof, which is a diverse and free-to-learn tech academy. What's really interesting about LaFosse is that everyone's a shareholder in the group, and the mission is to continue to rapidly grow a purpose-driven business with the hope of positively impacting the whole recruitment industry. LaFosse Associates have won many awards for growth and also the way they treat people, which they keep at the heart of their ethos as they continue to expand. The business is 15 years old, over 250 strong, has a number of UK offices and also operations in Los Angeles and New York. Simon, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
It's going to be, there's so much. I've wanted to talk to you for a few years, actually, so I'm glad we're finally doing this. We have a mutual connection. I don't know if you're aware of this, but Charlie Rawlings and Seb Sharp at Inventure Recruitment in LA. They speak very highly of you as a kind of, I think you're a friends of their family or one of their family, and they definitely regard you as a kind of role model and mentor. But they're members of my Apex Coaching and Peer Advisory Group, and they speak extremely highly of you. So,
oh, that's really nice to hear. Yeah, no, I don't know Seb so well, but I know Charlie. I know his dad really well. We ski together. We're good mates, and we live quite close to each other. And they've just set up an amazing business.
As you know,
they're young and they're just gone for it. And I just have huge amounts of respect for them, actually. So I've tried to give them a little bit of advice. They've come to me with a few really smart questions, and I've kind of done my best to help them. But they're doing brilliantly without my help. I can tell you that
they are doing absolutely amazing. Yeah, it's an honor to be part of their journey. So kinds of things I'd love to talk to you about today are, you know, the growth you've achieved is incredible, 30% annual growth over a 15-year period. But adjacent to that, or maybe kind of central to that, is the culture and the values that you've created at LaFosse, which is what you're famous for, and treating people in a certain way. And a lot of recruitment businesses pay lip service to this idea of values. And I wonder if you wouldn't mind sharing how that works at LaFosse. What, you know, tell us about the culture and how you've managed to retain that as you've grown and expanded and opened multiple offices.
Yeah, sure. So, the thought process behind it was kind of gloriously simple. I'm quite a straightforward person, and I'd spent I don't know how long, 15 years in recruitment before I set up LaFosse Associates. And what I'd noticed in terms of the way I just did what I did initially as a recruiter and then as a manager was that the better I treated people, the more successful I was. So whether that was candidates, whether it's clients, whether it was the people I work with. And that seemed to run slightly counter to the kind of general ethos of the recruitment industry at that point in time, you know, very competitive, very results oriented, very, very kind of cash focused, very short term focused. And to a certain extent, you've got to turn that on its head and go, it's not so much about what you're going to do this month. It's about how you've shown up as a person. And if you show up in the right way every moment of the day, then you're going to build something really substantial over time. And so that was what I'd been shown. That's what I'd been shown, really, in terms of my own building, my own kind of business within a business, as it were. So I just saw, you know, within the organization I was working in and also within the wider industry, that just wasn't widely adopted. So, and it felt increasingly like a key strategic advantage, apart from obviously just a kind of slightly more satisfying way to work and live your life. And so I looked around, actually, when I was thinking about leaving, and tried to find an organization that kind of espoused this, and I couldn't find one. So I was kind of like this reluctant entrepreneur, to be honest with you. I had three kids, a big mortgage, and it felt like probably not the most sensible thing to do. but I knew it was going to be successful. So I just started like that. So when you kind of start a business with that conviction, then the first bit's really easy because that's why you started it. So everything I did was towards that. And the people that came in mostly because they liked the culture and they saw the success. And so in the early days, it was very, very intentional. And it's still intentional now in terms of keeping that culture. But what I would say now is it has this amazing momentum of its own. And it's like a flywheel. People come in here and they're treated well by people who work here already. And so when it comes around to their turn to look after somebody that's coming in, they do the same. All the kind of normally contentious areas, look, we still fall out every now and again. There's still friction in this company. Of course, there's a bunch of ambitious people. But there is something where I think they really value the business that comes to us, the reputation we have, the enjoyment they get from working in that way. And so that is very self-sustaining. And that's the really, really exciting thing for me, because I was paranoid about this. You know, how do I keep the culture? Everybody says, you know, the moment you get past Dunbar's number, it's going to be really difficult because you don't know everybody and all the rest. But that is with the egotistical assumption that it's all about you, which of course it's not. It hasn't been for a long, long time. It's all about each other and whether collectively this is working for individuals. And people would much rather be nice to each other than not. So if you give them that as a starting point, they then see the results and they benefit from it, then you've got a really positive ecosystem that is pretty self-perpetuating, which isn't to say every now and again you need to step in, but you need to step in very carefully and very lightly, and you kind of coach rather than tell. So don't preach about it. But and that's the really exciting thing for me, actually. You can kind of see it in my face, this idea, you know, we're 250 now, that we go to... Because I was always kind of waiting for this moment where, you know, you felt you're on a slow glide down culture-wise, and it all became about structure and process and people didn't care as much. And I would say that the energy and the capability of the people in the organization is far surpassing mine now. So there's a very natural process whereby they've got more energy than I have, and they're passionate about this stuff. So actually, I see our journey from 250 to 500. In terms of keeping that culture and possibly even enhancing it slightly, I think that's very likely to happen. And without us having to manufacture engineer it too much, whether it does or not, you know, watch this space. But I'm generally a fairly anxious person. I think, you know, kind of only the paranoid survival, that kind of stuff. So I think it kind of helps to be like that. But I don't feel anxious about that, actually. I really think it will continue.
Fantastic. And it's interesting. We use the analogy of a flywheel a lot in our coaching program. I'm on a philosophical level, I totally buy into what you're sharing, Simon. I'm wondering, though, if you could walk me through some of the practicalities, or that, like, when you're designing a culture, rather than have a culture by default, which naturally tends to be similar to the personality of the founder or the original directors, and it's a cult of personality, and it's the culture sort of emanates from there. It sounds like you've gone in and intentionally designed things to be a certain way with a certain philosophy. But how do you construct that? Like, could you give some practical steps around that?
Yeah, I mean, firstly, I'd like to think it's not about a kind of cult of personality. It's about behavioral traits. So, you know, some of which I exhibit, some of which I don't, but all of which I think are good. So it definitely isn't about me, and I'm not capable enough. And I have so many, you know, all sorts of failings that I actually wouldn't want it to be. Look at me and do that. You know, some of the stuff I do is good, but it's about take that, not just kind of watch me. So firstly, it's simply not about that. It's simply about a kind of behavioral framework that, if you know, behavioral framework sounds very HR, doesn't it? It's actually just about being a decent person. And if you keep that close to mind, then we all know what that means. You interpret it in different ways. It means slightly different things to each person, but that's really good because that gives it integrity. That keeps it alive. It's like, you know, what for you is an act of kindness will be slightly different for somebody else, but they'll both feel kind when they're offered to somebody else, and they'll feel very genuine if it's what you think is appropriate. I'm not sure that answers your question, but
well, it's the start of an answer. So first of all, it's behaviors, behavioral traits, and being a decent person is one of those things. Are there other specific behaviors which are sort of woven into the DNA of the business that you are the things that you select for when you hire people, that you also reinforce through training and through what gets recognized, what gets rewarded, and so on?
Yeah, so it's three very simple values: care, ambition, and humility. Care we've touched on and all that speaks to. Ambition, you know, if you've got a lot of care and a lot of humbleness, you're not necessarily going to grow a business. So I think it's really important to balance those two with ambition, and that's individual ambition as well as group ambition. So we want people that are, you know, that don't want an easy life, that haven't come, you know, to Sleepy Hollow to kind of just enjoy a slow pace of life. We want people who really want to be the best they can, but the best they can as defined by those other two, which is care and humility. And so they sit nicely together. They're kind of juxtapositioned a little bit, and there's a little bit of friction between them, but I think they work really well. And the humility bit kind of comes after the care and the ambition, right? Because if you get the care and the ambition right, you become very successful individually and as a company. So what happens when people enjoy a lot of success, especially when they're young? Well, guess what? You know, it changes the way they see things a little bit. So you've really got to keep that humbleness as well. Because otherwise that then eats the other two, I think. So on the face of it, it's a really simple thing: ambition, care, humility, but together they're very powerful.
I love that. And humility is and ambition. The care one is interesting. I'd like to explore that further, but the ambition and humility together is absolutely what we look for when we're selecting people to become clients of ours. And on the show, like you, I think you've listened to a few episodes. Some people who are super successful also have quite large egos, and that can be entertaining, and that's, you know, interesting to interview people. But as far as who I want to spend time with on a daily basis and really, you know, work with on a deeper level, that just does not work for me. I want to work with people who have that humble self-confidence. So the ambition I get, the humility I get, what does care look like within the context of a recruitment business? Because that one's seems like the hardest to kind of embed.
It's so many things. I think first of all, you've got to select for it as an innate trait. So if you have somebody that's a bit selfish or kind of got low emotional intelligence, then they're probably going to find it difficult to live that one really well. I think it's people, you know, I was speaking to a manager the other day, a really nice guy, and he was very successful, then went into management, and he said, the thing that amazed me, Simon, and I think he was being genuine, he said, the thing that amazed me was, you know, I just got such a kick out of being successful myself. He said, but when the first person I managed did their first deal, he said, that gave me more pleasure than anything. And then you just kind of go, no, you know, that's going to be a successful manager. And it's lovely to be able to say that, because that's where they get a kick. It's not about them. It's about other people. So care, look, it's so multifaceted, but you know when you're dealing with a caring, sincere person when you're not. And so select those people, and you're most of the way there, especially if you put them in an environment that's already like that. And that's the lucky thing we have. You know, specifically, what does it mean? Well, you know, when you're talking to candidates, it means giving them feedback that isn't the feedback they want to hear, but doing it in a way that where you take care with it, right? So you don't just send them an email, or you don't leave them hanging. You call them quickly. Even sometimes, if you haven't got anything to say, you just say, like, I want you to know that there's been no update. I'm trying to push it through, but you know, you can't. And so all of those things, we know what care feels like when we're a candidate. Yeah. And care sometimes is giving tough feedback, right? So when you said this, that really put me off, or, and that can be in appraisals internally, that can be to candidates. Care also, I think, with clients is not just saying, yeah, yeah, we'll find the person. It's going, well, actually, to be honest with you, that if you keep, if you ask for those three things, and it's at this salary level, I think we're really going to struggle with it. And they appreciate that, you know,
on the, absolutely.
You've got to work a little bit harder. The easiest thing is to go, yeah, 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 we'll go and find you one, and then come back and go, well, actually, you've got to pay 10K more. And then suddenly they kind of go, well, you took it on that base, you know. So all of those things, I think they're very small examples, but it is actually difficult to define. I think one of the important things we do is we don't try and define what an act of care is. Rather, we try and recognize when we see it. So one of the things we do every week without fail is at the Friday wrap-up is we try to talk less about the people who are being commercially successful and more about the people who are being culturally successful. So there's a culture award every week, and we just ask people to nominate people. And generally we have, I would say, 20 to 30 individual comments that where they talk specifically about what it was they did for them that week that they didn't need to. So we're not talking about a manager looking up, you know, we're talking about unexpected acts of kindness that has made somebody's days better. That is definitely a mechanism that helps keep it alive. You know, we have other cultural awards throughout the year. There's some incentives attached to them. So we're not saying that it's all about billing. We're saying actually, you know, that side of it is just as important. And I think you've got to keep noticing it. You know, what's that lovely phrase? Catch them doing something right. And I think that helps to keep it alive. But it isn't, you know, that phrase, again, I seem to be speaking cliches here, what you measure, you can manage, kind of thing.
Yes.
But you've got to be careful because you can kill it by trying to measure it, right? Exactly. But you can recognize it when it's happening, and that's the thing I think that we're probably trying to focus on most.
Amazing. Okay. Cool. I did a poll on LinkedIn recently to find out what fee percentage recruiters charge, and it confirmed what I'd learned from speaking with so many recruiters every day. The majority of recruiters are undervaluing their service and cutting their fees to become more competitive. Listen, if you want to protect your cash flow and build reserves to protect your business against whatever might happen in the future, you need to be earning more for each placement, not less. The challenge, of course, is how to increase your fees and still be competitive. iIntro has helped hundreds of recruiters to make small but critical adjustments to the way they pitch and win business so they can win more clients who are also willing to pay higher fees. For example, one of their clients typically earned £5,000 per placement, but just a few weeks after working with iIntro, she won a new piece of business on a retainer. So in other words, she got a deposit and her fee was an incredible £20,000, four times her average. If you'd like to see how iIntro can help you to grow your recruitment business and increase your average fees, just go to recruitmentcoach.com/retained and book a free consultation. There's no obligation. And if you mention that you're a listener of the Resilient Recruiter podcast, iIntro have pledged to offer you a 25% discount off any of their services. Just go to recruitmentcoach.com/retained to get started.
So I'd like to, we'll circle back to the assessment part because a lot of recruiting companies are in growth mode right now. And ironically, recruiting recruiters can be very challenging. But tell me more about these culture awards and how you celebrate success at LaFosse. What else are you guys doing on that front?
Again, I think you've got to be careful with that because in the past, you know, celebrating success can be going down the pub and getting drunk, right? And that isn't necessarily where great things happen, especially later on in the evening. So what we do try and find is a whole variety of different things that we can do together as a team that are sometimes partly connected with some kind of training message. They're always fun, right? So, but often it's about something that involves some teamwork. It may be go-karting, it may be virtual reality, it may be, you know, there's a whole bunch of different things that we do. canoeing recently. It's at the Olympic Park was something that somebody else did. We have a very famous annual ski trip, as well as you can see behind me some of the examples where everybody dresses up on one day, which is great fun. And so there's again a lot of it's down to individual manager discretion. And the lovely thing about the managers, they often go, hey, what do you want to do? What should we do? So it's a kind of combination of us making an effort to take time to call out the good things, but not imposing our view of what celebrating those things should look like.
Okay, excellent. So you have some things that you've traditionally done, like the annual ski trip, and then you also have some room to get input from the team and from managers. What do people actually want to do to celebrate? But are these things, do you have to qualify, for example, to go to the ski trip based on performance?
No.
And
that's a really good question and a really important point. So your qualification for the ski trip is that you work for the company. And you know, there are separate ones that are about high performance, and that's appropriate as well. But you know, like the culture awards, you know, whether it's the person who's got a tough job of collecting the debt or making sure that contract administration is as good as it should be, all of these people, without these people, we can't do our job.
Yes.
And so there's this kind of understanding that those people are just as important, and you may well be paid differently, and that's the reality, but that doesn't mean that you're a second class citizen. And so I think getting everybody on the ski trip is really key to that. And a lot of the things we do are about company wide things. Like we have a wonderful sports day that everybody comes to. There's a whole bunch of things. And I think that's pretty critical.
Fantastic. So this culture award is a weekly. People nominate a colleague who they've observed demonstrate one of the values, and mm-hmm. they'll put them forward. And then is there a prize, or is it just the recognition?
There's recognition, which I think is probably the most important thing.
Yeah.
There's generally a bottle of champagne.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's more than one winner. But everybody gets a few of them get picked and read out, and the person that's got the most nominations or done the most amazing thing gets an award. And the next on Monday, the list of it all comes around, and it's really heartwarming to see. And you know, the other thing is that's clearly just one example of it. I think you can't get promoted in this company if you're not exhibiting those, you know, and so you've got to embed it in some of the more prosaic kind of control mechanisms if you're going to be serious about it. But I think that comes to a policing thing. And whilst it's important to have it there, that's not the thing that will drive it. I think the thing that will drive it is people appreciating it and it being publicized. And you know, there's a real challenge with that as well. How do you keep that fresh? And the team that generally present these take real time, not just to trot out the same old email every week, and they take real time to think about those particular acts that they're going to call out. And also, what you'll find over time is that more, you know, that there's a group of people that seem to keep on getting mentioned in dispatches, as it were. So what we do on a quarterly basis and annual basis is recognize who was nominated most of the time. So it kind of collects up as well. And at the end of the year, we, as you can imagine, we have all sorts of kind of cash and other incentives. But the only thing that we allocate share options to as a result of winning is the culture award. And that's really important, because if you think of it as a co-owned company, then the people that are making the most effort towards perpetuating and promoting the culture internally through their own behavior are the ones that will be given more share options in the company. And share options come for all sorts of different achievements, as you can imagine. But I love the fact that at the end of the year, there isn't the highest biller or whatever it may be that gets a bunch of share options. It's the person that has most demonstrated and through their own behaviors perpetuated the kind of culture and values of the company that gets a share option grant.
Okay, this blows my mind because I definitely want to talk more about this, because the share ownership is something that you guys are famous for across the industry. Before we do that, can I just ask the assessment piece of trying to measure the behaviors, both when you're recruiting somebody and then when someone is up for promotion, how do you accomplish that? Because you can measure past, you know, track record in terms of sales performance or billings, or, you know, if someone was competitive, if they were a champion skier or a marathon runner or captain of their rugby team or whatever, you can look at these things. But how do you assess and really measure the culture fit from a values perspective?
And it's, you know, again, it's not so much a culture fit, and it kind of is. So I know I'm being a bit contrary here, but it's more about, are they a kind, caring person? And those things, I think, they're difficult to measure exactly.
For sure.
But I think you can get a good sense of them at interview, and especially when you have a number of people interviewing, and especially when you the people interviewing are from that environment. And to supplement that, we have some really good psychometrics which help as well. And also, I think that whole kind of EQ measure, you know, emotional intelligence, I think. If you've got poor emotional intelligence, I think you may be a kind person, but you may not see the opportunities always to contribute. So right. I think that helps. It doesn't drive it, but and of course, good recruiters are all about good emotional intelligence. So I think that, you know, that for me fits with that. So sometimes it's looking for. It's not actually looking for those things, although clearly we do. Sometimes it's about trying to avoid other things. So somebody who's clearly confrontational, who's clearly a bit selfish, particularly egotistical, perhaps a little bit, if they find feedback hard to take, you know, because of insecurity or because they're insecure, because there's a big ego or they're just fragile, then... you know, that's a big negative flag for us as well, because a lot of what we're trying to do is we're growing the business by 30% every year. So people have got to grow very fast. You know, they've got to really want to be able to develop. And in order to do that, you've got to be very open to feedback. Often feedback you don't want to hear, right? Because we all like to hear the feedback. So like, you're doing a fantastic job, but the really valuable stuff is actually you are doing a good job. But if you did this differently, or, you know, you could achieve this, and being open to that as opposed to going immediately into defensive mode is really important.
Yes.
And so... we'll use those scenarios in an interview situation to understand whether they're likely to be able to take that well. And of course, they're on best behavior in an interview, but even then, sometimes you'll find there's this natural desire to kind of go, oh yeah, but, and that's immediately, you kind of close down the opportunity for learning there.
Fantastic. So it sounds like the interview is structured to come at these issues a little bit more obliquely. You're not directly asking behavioral questions on, you know, humility or kindness or whatever. You're assessing it by the way that they answer the other questions, or
sometimes a little bit of both. And okay. I think it's important to play around with all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And you know, we have yet to design the perfect interview process that gives us exactly the same results. And of course, you know, people change over time as well, don't they? So you've got to accept responsibility for that. And somebody that was positive that becomes slightly less positive, the chances are that's not them actually. The chances are that's something to do with you or the environment or the stress that they're under. But if you take the time, you take the care to find out what those things are, then instead of just putting them into a box and going, oh, they used to be positive, they're now negative, that's their problem. It's like, how have I failed in my job as a manager that somebody who used to be this way is now feeling like this? What could I be doing? And again, that comes back to what personal responsibility can you take for your team, for the culture, as opposed to, you know, what are you going to do for me? And I just kind of love that. I love that idea of as many of us as possible thinking that way, because if you do, it's a really powerful thing, because you become part of the, you know, again, talking cliches a little bit, you become part of the solution as opposed to part of the problem. And you know, that's one thing we hate here is is people who are really good at presenting problems. It's like, I found a problem in the company. Oh, well done. Good for you. You're just going to leave that here now, are you? You know, whereas actually, you know, the people that are oblivious to that are not particularly helpful, but the great ones are the ones that go, I've seen this and I reckon maybe we could do this differently. And you go, okay, at least we've got a starting point there. Yeah, maybe that's a fantastic idea. Actually, chances are, because you're at grassroots, you understand it much better than I do. You've probably got a much better solution than I have. So maybe that is the solution. But even if it isn't the solution, we've got a start of something, which is, okay, that seems good. What about this? Oh, yeah, maybe that. Or maybe both of those things. Yeah, okay, let's do that. And that you've just got to love. And if you've got an environment where people do care, where they care for each other and they care for the place they're working for, they're much more likely to try and do that stuff. As you know, and also, guess what? Have a sense that they own part of it, which they do.
Yes.
Then suddenly it's not them and us. It's not this other entity. It's my entity. And how can I make that better? And that is all quite exciting. And look, you know, I'd love to say it always feels like that all of the time, but it's those kind of things, those moments that we're striving for, and we're trying to find and encourage that will help this organization get better, no matter what size it is, because everybody's doing it.
Amazing. Let's talk about the ownership then, because I can totally see how someone who has equity feels like this is their company and are motivated completely differently to someone who's just got an employee mindset. And I've interviewed quite a few CEOs who do give... So maybe this, you can explain how this works at LaFosse, because most of the entrepreneurs I've spoken to give share options, and there's a share option scheme in the UK that people can participate in. So they sort of say, look, come on this journey with us, and at X point, there will be an exit event of some kind, and you'll have the opportunity to participate in that. So just like stick with us for the next 5 years and... you know, and perform, and, you know, you will be rewarded. How does that compare to what you guys are doing at LaFosse?
Well, for me, the quantum's the important thing. And as you say, almost every recruitment company's offers share options or equity of some sort. But there's two things that are important. One is, what's the total percentage? Yeah. So it's, you know, 5 or 10%. It's like, it's fine. If that's how you want to run the company, that's absolutely fine. But it's not the way we've chosen to do it. So we think a more substantial percentage is just much fairer. I started the business. And I took the risk, and but you know, I'm one person amongst 250, and I don't do much billing anymore. So you can see where the value is being created, and it's not me. So I think to say, 60% seems really fair to leave me with, and 40% just seems like a fairer deal, I think. So that quantum's important, and I think the second thing is that's important for us is that everybody has something. You know, mm-hmm. so from the people in ops, the receptionist, to the people who literally started a few days ago, they'll all have share options, and I think that is a really important part of it as well. So it's not just seen again, because if it's overly concentrated in the upper management, then again it's a them or us thing. It's very easy for it to become like that. And of course, the senior people in the organization that have been here the longest and contributing the most and they're making the most strategic difference to the value of the company in the future, they have a larger amount of share options, and so they should. But that doesn't mean that everybody can't have them. And you know, to be honest, for people coming in as a grad, their grant is pretty small, as you can imagine. It has to be, or we can't spread it out in that way. But as they progress in terms of they're developing and as an individual and they're here over time, they can expect the share option grants to increase again, not massively, because there is a limited amount. We have to allocate it really fairly. Mm-hmm. But that principle, and I think for people, you know, if we do sell the company or float the company or do something with it, then the people that have just joined the organization won't receive much, and you know, that's a fact. But
of course, well, yeah, that's just, it makes total sense. You can't, the people who've been with you and have contributed over time and created the most value need to to get more than the person who's just joined yesterday, right? That, but even just psychologically, to feel like you are part, a real part of the business, I think that's powerful. So we've talked a lot about culture and values, but you've started coming on there about the fact of commercial success, because you have been extremely successful in that sense as well, in terms of growth, in terms of profitability. So could you talk a little bit about that? Because that commercial success has been exceptional as well. If you think there's 27,000 recruitment companies in the UK or something like that, and you guys are towards the top, you know, percentile of that in terms of size, in terms of turnover, in terms of profit, whatever measure you choose, what do you think have been the critical success factors to achieving that?
Care, ambition, and humility is a very...
Okay, all right. So you're going to go back to the...
Yeah. I am, actually. I am. I think continually ambitious.
Yeah.
So you're continuing to be the best you can. We never sit back and go, oh, we're great, aren't we? Mm-hmm. You know, we do enjoy that moment, but we move on fairly swiftly to, you know, what can we do? What can we do next? What has this allowed us? What platform is this giving us to kind of go on and do better things? And that is genuinely exciting. I think keeping care at the center of things is so simple. You know, we've got this great big neon sign behind the reception desk that just says care. And it is such a simple thing, but everybody knows what that means. So holding on to that very dearly. And as, you know, as we've talked about before, that idea of don't let hubris get in the way. Don't start to believe your own story too much. So you know, stay humble.
So I totally accept that if you have those core values at the center of the business, as well as individually how people are operating, for sure it's intangible, but I'm positive it's had been a, you know, one of the key contributing factors to your success. Having said that, you still need effective strategies and techniques to, you know, turn those values into productive work and placements and so on. So, you know, what do you think you're doing differently there that separates you from other recruitment businesses?
I think the process has come out of that, to be honest with you. So if you're taking care with the way you design a process, the promotional, the way you review people, you take more care with that. The people you promote, you take more care with that. The when they become managers, you take a lot of care in terms of the way that you train them. And when they're having a tough time, you take a lot of care with that. And I know it's again, it sounds very simple, but I don't, you know, there are mechanisms that need to sit behind it. I mean, a good example is, you know, how do we measure whether our culture is good? Because, you know, that's an easy thing to say, isn't it? But you need to be able to measure that really, really tightly. And we do through a whole variety of ways. So if you look at attrition, that's a great sign. If you look at office vibe, which is something we use, it gives us great ongoing feedback on a daily basis as to what teams are feeling good, what they're feeling good about, what they're not feeling so good about. So you can identify it and change and take actions as you need to. Glassdoor again is a lovely way of giving you a good sense of what's going on in the organization as well. We use NPS as well. We use that internally actually as part of the whole kind of office vibe score. We also use externally with our clients. So all of those things we're tracking, all of those things are very, very clear, hard metrics that are measuring those things. And but yeah, look, there's a whole load of processes that I could bore you to death with that sit behind how we assess people, how we keep them engaged, how we promote them, how we set up new markets, and they are becoming more robust as we're getting larger. But also, then this is a really interesting thing, isn't it? You don't want to be too robust, because the moment they're too robust, it's like this is the menu, this is what we do. So you've got to find this happy space between this is what we have in place now and it's fit for purpose now, but we kind of like the idea and it's robust enough to be able to be implemented and followed up, but it's not so set in stone that 5 years' time, when it isn't fit for purpose anymore, that we're still kind of adhering to it. So you've got to find that way of being able to iterate on things and constantly improve them. And we don't always get that right, but there's that sense of that is certainly sits behind what we're trying to do. And in some other areas of our business, it's almost the opposite, actually. So we've got some more entrepreneurial parts of our business, like Future Proof and Digital Outcomes, where we're actually doing the opposite because we don't have processes. We're trying to find the market and we're trying to find the best way of doing something in a new space. So there, it's very much that kind of whole, startup culture of fail fast, try some experiments, be bold with that, but measure it carefully. And look at the data and change what you're doing if the data is telling you that perhaps wasn't the greatest idea. But you've got to be really fast on that and really incisive. But it all comes back to measurement. So, whilst ambition, care, and humility sits at the heart of everything, it doesn't mean that we don't put some very clear metrics around everything to be able to take it away from a kind of subjective opinion to a much more objective sense of where we're going. And also importantly, which way are we trending? Are we trending up or down? So right now, the business is doing fabulously on all the measures. And it's good to know that every single measure, whether it's financial or in terms of the kind of culture and the values. But guess what? We're in a great market as well. So the question for me is not, are we doing better? Well, of course we're doing better. It's, are we doing better relative to the market? Yes. And also, are we doing as well as we should be, bearing in mind how much higher the market is? And also, are we in danger of believing it's all about us and or adding cost that is going to hurt us when the market takes a dip, which it inevitably will? And when you've got to my ripe old age, Mark, it's just a matter of when, not if.
Absolutely. You've seen it multiple times, I'm sure.
Look, sadly, I have.
You, there's no way you could bore me with process because I'm fascinated by all that stuff. Just to clarify, NPS is Net Promoter Score, for those who may not be familiar with the term. Glassdoor is a good tip. Vibe, how do you measure vibe?
So it's called Office Vibe. It's actually a software product. And I should have shares in the company because I talk about it a lot. And look, there's a number of software companies that have a similar thing, but we think Office Vibe is good. But it's a constant measuring tool that you use. So it surveys people on a kind of daily, weekly basis with different questions. Some of them from us, some of them a bit random. They ask the same questions in a different way. And you need a good level of engagement is an interesting point on that. Because if you're getting feedback just from a small percentage, then you're not really getting a great feel. And often it's the percentage that aren't replying that are the ones you have to look out for. But our engagement at the moment, we were talking about it just the other day, it's 58%. And in the past, it's been kind of in the mid-60s. So that's something we're working at. And again, to have that kind of honesty internally is really important, as opposed to going, oh, Office Vibe scores are great, at board level. And then, at a kind of mid-management level, they go, well, that's because, we're not bothering too much about the ones that aren't. And I think it came not from me, but from the middle of the organization to say, they are good, but what about the people that aren't engaged? How do we increase their engagement? And I just love that because they're making their job hard in a way, because they're going to get some negative feedback by getting those people engaged, but they're not actually, because they're thinking in a really mature way about it, which is like, those are the disengaged people. So those are the ones that are likely to leave. Those are the ones that won't be performing as well. Those are the ones that are dragging the culture down. So those are the ones actually that we really need to hear from. And we need to find out why they're not happy, because the chances are, because they're good people, they wouldn't be here. Chances are they've got a good reason for not feeling great. And so what is it we can do about that?
That is amazing. I think most companies, recruitment or otherwise, in any company, they don't really look at that. They, it's a great point. If your score is only based on you're measuring engagement based on the people who are already engaged, then it's a false measure, isn't it?
Exactly. That's not always the case. Often there are some people, who are giving you feedback you don't want to hear.
Yes.
So, for the unknowns, they're exactly that. They're just unknown.
I definitely want to learn about future proof, but before we do that, on the subject of metrics, because that's something I'm really interested in, what are the other key metrics that you pay attention to, Simon?
All the ones you'd expect us to. So we're very good at looking at prospects as so the top of the funnel. And we look at that in a whole number of different ways because we see that as a, you know, we've got enough data to know that it's just a predictor of future revenue. And I think if you look at that well enough and the quality of that data is good enough, and that's always a constant struggle as well because it's changing the whole time, then the really interesting thing there is you can start to change the future. So when your prospects are telling you that you're going to be 10 or 20% below budget in, say, 2 months, 2 or 3 months' time, then guess what? You've actually got an opportunity to change that. So you've got to do it relatively quickly. So whether that's a BD drive, whether that's, well, there's all sorts of things you can do, but clearly a lot of the time it's just driving up the activity, whether it's a marketing initiative or whether it's changing the focus on work in progress to generating new work. You've got mechanisms there through processes, as you say, that allow you not to look at prospects and go, oh, that means we're going to have a tough month in a couple of months, because if we don't do something within the next week, we're going to do that. And then that's really exciting because you kind of go, actually, we were down, spotted it early, rectified it. We are only below for a week. It's going to have no material impact on revenues in 2 to 3 months' time. And we've seen something off that would otherwise just have surprised us. So I love all the stuff you can put in that kind of allows, that isn't retrospective, you know, that allows you to change the future for you potentially. And you know what? Office Vibe is a good example of that. You know, Glassdoor and attrition, guess what? Actually, not Glassdoor, because it's a lot of the people that are still here are applying to that. Let's say attrition. Attrition's a lagging indicator that's fairly useless, right? It just tells you that you're doing stuff wrong after the horse has bolted. So Office Vibe tells you that you're doing stuff wrong, but you've got a chance to fix it, and good forward indication of future revenue in terms of various different ways of looking at your kind of prospect pipeline. Again, gives you an opportunity to make sure that the near-term future is what you want it to be.
Fantastic. So for prospects at the top of the funnel, what is the lead indicator? Is it conversations? Is it client meetings? Like what do you choose?
It's different for different businesses. So we have a big search business, and that's quite a lumpy revenue. You know, a good fee there is 100,000.
Yeah.
So that's much more difficult to predict. We also may do some work for a private equity company where we'll have suddenly five or six of those assignments come on at one point in time. So trying to predict that's a bit of a nightmare. And at the other end of the spectrum, the kind of contract business is much easier to predict. And often it goes straight to working on, so you have no prospects. So sometimes you've got to use prospects and work in progress together in quite a sophisticated way to understand exactly where you are. Okay. And with some of our future proof work, again, what we find is that they're often taking a number of people from us when they start working with us from day one. So again, you know, how do you measure the value of that? Do you measure it as one person, or you don't actually? You measure a deal, a prospective deal, as, say, two people, because that's the average that they take. So you know, this stuff is, sorry, I'm probably boring with the detail here.
No, but not at all. As I said, impossible. that's what I want to latch on to. But look, we're short on time. I feel like I could talk to you for hours, Simon. It's really fascinating. Tell me about Future Proof. What is that all about?
So Future Proof, we are really properly excited about, because it's this opportunity for us to help address the diversity issue and the shortage in the industry. So recruiters very fairly are often criticized for moving people around, whereas we've got a chronic shortage of tech talent, especially in software engineering. So this gives us an opportunity to train people free of charge. So it's expensive for us. It cost us nearly £1 million. We invested over £1 million last year. Or actually, the total cost, we invested more than £1 million. The total cost was not far short of £1 million of profit to us. So we select people. We select that we recruit graduates. We select just the top 2 or 3%. So we have outstanding people. We then train them free, completely free of charge for 13 weeks, and then we'll then place them on client site for a two year period, and hope and try and encourage the client and the individual to work well together, so that they then become permanent members of staff after those 2 years. And the lovely thing about it is, we're not asking them to fork out, as you know, some of these training courses cost £9,000 or £10,000, which means that you're selecting on the ability to pay rather than their ability to be really good at what they do. Mm. So we're not doing that. Clearly, there's a trade-off, isn't there, between needing to recoup that money over a two-year period with a client. But we found what we think is a really good way to do that. And the feedback from the students and the clients is fantastic on that. So despite it being kind of quite an expensive thing for us to invest in, it's allowing us to present properly diverse shortlists of potential junior software engineers to our clients in every sense, ethnically, in terms of gender, in terms of economic background. And that's massively well received. As you know, that's only becoming more and more genuinely important as organizations realize they just can't succeed with the kind of the old, very imbalanced position that they're in.
Amazing. So are you're training people and placing them in technical roles?
Yeah, we are, mostly software engineers. Yep. At this point in time, and the really exciting thing about it is there's a few companies out there that do it, but most of the companies are trying to don't have the kind of network we have. So we have 250 people out there, you know, 15 years of working with the same decision makers that are choosing to hire software engineers. And so we've got this massive head start where if we can make the academy absolutely brilliant, which we have, and again, the metrics support that in terms of the kind of Glassdoor and Office Vibe scores, not just while we're training them, but whilst they're on client site, which is better than any other competition. Being able to do that in a really high quality way, and benefit from this massive network we have, not just in terms of knowing so many tech decision makers, but having the kind of reputation we do, and presenting them with the solution to their problem, which is, I can't hire really good devs. Well, you can now. And they are inexperienced, but they've had a great training. And because they're top 2 or 3%, they're going to be fantastic. It's a diverse group of people. So that is really exciting. It's difficult because it's new and it's a totally different concept to, you know, when I find somebody with 3 years experience. But what we're finding again is that flywheel effect, that the clients that have taken it are saying this is brilliant, and they're taking more, and that is helping us to prove to the marketplace that it's a powerful way of moving ahead going forward. But it is it's not for everybody, because we've been doing this for 3 years and it's yet to make money, but we're confident in terms of the way it's trading that it will start to repay and in fact be a major value driver for us as a business.
It's amazing. Like, the thing is with recruitment, okay, there's technological advancement, but really there's not a whole lot that we're doing differently over 50 years or whatever, right? And innovation in recruiting is pretty rare. And so it's cool from that point of view, but it's also really a powerful differentiator, something, you know, that it's because so many recruiters do more or less the same thing, or at least that's the perception of clients, that it can be hard to capture the attention of the market, clients and candidates. And you have something really radically different to talk to them about, whether or not they ultimately choose to take it up. That's, I'm sure it's opening a lot of doors and creating a lot of really high level conversations for you. So
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And initially, when we were asking people who are, guess what, really busy doing their own work, working their own vertical, to say, and can you talk to them about this? It was like, well, I can, but I'm busy, or I don't really fully understand it. And that was part of the reason it's taken us a while to get there. And now, that's exactly the feedback we're getting. Oh, wow, I've started a conversation with a client that just wasn't interested in talking to me before. Or, you know, whether it's the diversity play or whether it's the fact that this is a potential solution, a long-term solution to the kind of talent shortage of software engineers, it raises the conversation from, you know, that kind of got any jobs to something that's more strategically important. So not only are the heads of software engineering interested, but guess what? The CIO is interested, the HRD is interested, and it does. It's not easy because we've got really busy people being experts in their own verticals, managers who are you know, rushed off their feet. So trying to find the slow time to think about how you do present something differently and that's additive to your day job, as opposed to, you know, diminishing your ability to be effective. Those are quite subtle things. And it's about organization, it's about education, it's about training, it's about hearts and minds, and it's about appropriate rewards as well. So we're working all of that stuff through, but you kind of know there's a big prize there because it's a really good business model if we can get it working, or when we get it working. And you also know it's the right solution, strategic solution for the industry, because we need to put more people into it, and it needs to become more diverse, because there's nothing more dysfunctional than a white male tech function.
Totally. So this is amazing, Simon. How can people find out more about Future Proof then?
Go to our website and
lafosse.com,
which is lafosse.com. Just Google Lafosse and it'll take you there. It takes you to two places, actually. It takes you to Lafosse Associates and also a small guest house in Dorset.
Okay. Hilarious.
We're the first one.
Okay. Excellent. Simon, this has been brilliant. Thanks so much for sharing your wisdom and insight today. I really appreciate it.
It's been an absolute pleasure.